Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. It's brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Sarah Bernstein, author of Study for Obedience. It's published by Knopf and released just a few days ago, actually. Sarah's earlier work includes Now Comes the Lightning, a collection of prose poems. Her first novel was The Coming Bad Days. Study for Obedience was longlisted for the Booker Prize this year. So I've often pondered moving to an unnamed northern country, one where there are automatic doors at airports that refuse to open, the doors, that is, where I could organize my consciousness, watch creatures make their froggy way, gaze at the soul of a lake, listen to a refrigerator in an empty house at night, and watch the trees cover a bit more of the sky each year. But what if I felt really bad about myself and everyone else did too? I mean, like, what if my siblings, my whole family, my whole extended family, an entire town felt derision for me, derision and fear and hatred? I would kind of burst the bubble. And then what if I tried to explain this to you reliably? At least I would feel that way, or not. I don't know what you would feel that way. And what if during that time, in fact, during an entire life, or before or after, I was trying my hardest, yearning to be obedient, and maybe not even knowing why? And as usual, in my introductions, I have actually confused myself. So let's let Sarah clarify. So hi, Sarah. How are you doing today?
Hi. I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, so first, the recipe for gefilte fish and the mention of chopped liver and herring are really familiar since I have eaten all three in the past week or so. But good for being an old white Jewish guy. I guess there's a lot of old white, no, there's a lot of old Jewish men, and I guess pretty much of them are white, other than the followers of Haile Selassie. So do you like any of those foods? Stupid. Not a question.
I used to really like chopped liver when I was a kid, actually. My grandmother would serve it every Friday night at Shabbat, but I am a vegetarian now.
Okay, that leaves a lot of stuff out. Maybe simus. Yeah. I can't remember whether simus has meat in it or not. And I like the expression, like you would too, like make a simus out of something.
Yeah. What is simus again?
I don't know. I can't remember. All I know is I hated it. I'll have to look it up afterwards. Okay, so speaking of throwing things like that in, have you read a lot of Italo Calvino?
I haven't read a lot, but I have read a bit of Italo Calvino. Yeah, so Invisible Cities.
Yes, yeah, okay. I was just talking about that book yesterday. But like, if you read Cosmic Comics, you will really see, especially the idea of caring for your children, caring for your siblings when you have no motor skills and can't even speak, and yet you're giving them cigarettes and liquor and aperitifs. That's totally Calvino. So,
get it.
Yeah, it's a compliment. I didn't necessarily mean it to be a compliment, but it's definitely true. So you should definitely read the entire Cosmic Comics. You will definitely love it. But yeah, so that's the thing about this book. I mean, there's so many ways you can come at it, because some of it's absurd in the good sense, because that could never happen. And why do you why do you carefully insert incidents like those that are impossible, but when you read the book, seem quite possible, actually?
That's a very good question. I think, like the situation with obedience being potentially murderous, so that idea that I got from Paul Arago, there is something implausible about that situation, or unlikely about that situation, which might spawn a number of other unlikely situations insofar as one tries to be obedient in various ways. I also think I was interested in with this book, in trying to play with the limits of the absurd, because the humor is not something a lot of reviewers pick up on in the book. I think a lot of people read it pretty straight-faced, which is fair enough. But I think there are certain things that the narrator says which sort of stretch the limits of believability in various ways, and which throw into question her reliability as a narrator too. Is she, you know, are we supposed to understand that these things literally happened, or is there some degree of invention on her part and some degree of pleasure in the telling of the story as well? So I think part of it has to do with the way I wanted to portray this character as a storyteller too, as somebody conscious of creating a specific narrative.
Yeah, and they pop up everywhere. I mean, just like the idea of the brother being his siblings being taking the part of their mother from the time he was born or before. And you stop and go back and read that again. Did she say or before? And yes, she did say or before. And you're right, in the reviews, the word dread is used over and over again, like we talked about before we began here. And there is an enormous amount of humor in the book. And then some of the reviewers are going, well, some of the like Goodread reviewers are going, oh, well, nothing happens. But that's not true. A lot of stuff happens. It's just that there's not a well-defined plot, which means nothing to me. That's not what I'm reading for. So yeah. Did you think about, you know, the closest that came to a plot is like her going down to the village and seeing what happens, because that was fascinating too. But yeah. What were you doing when you, I mean, you weren't sticking 3x5 cards up against a bulletin board, or maybe you were you?
No, that's not at all how I write. I think I'm not really a writer who is much interested in plot. I'm interested in narrative, and I'm interested in voice, and I'm interested in story. But plot, which is to say a series of external actions that occur and you know, are very legible to a kind of external reading, I'm not that interested in, I guess, which is, well, I'm not that interested in it right now anyway. And the books I like to read don't have much plot either. Not to say that I might not find a plot that, that I like someday. So I think, you know, it's primarily a book about the way somebody narrates their own experience, right? And I'm always interested in why people tell stories about themselves or about other people in certain ways, like what they're hiding, what they're trying to get across, what they're trying to communicate, because it's never the thing that is said that is exclusively what is being communicated. There's something underneath that shows, you know, what the person wants other people to think of them, I think.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, your collection is a prose poems, and in a lot of ways I felt the same with regard to this. Like I said in the introduction, when you're watching creatures make their froggy way, or you gaze at the soul of a lake, or listening to a refrigerator humming in an empty house at night, or watching the trees cover a little bit more, that's poetry to me. And that inflects or informs a lot of the book, doesn't it? If you thought of it that way, I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely did. I think the things that resonate with me as a reader are the sound of language and also specific images that are created, not necessarily a series of events that I, you know, have experienced myself. I think that's not really the kind of reader I am. So because those are the kinds of books that I read, those tend to be the kinds of things that I write. You know, I think when I read a really powerful image that sort of doesn't have a clear correlate in terms of an obvious meaning or an obvious significance, that's what I find really interesting in a text. You know what? Because it sort of makes you think about why it's there. What is the writer doing? It draws attention to something about the way that the book or the writing is operating. That I think is interesting, that makes you think about, you know, how you might approach things differently as a reader too, not just looking for plot, but sort of dwelling in these moments a little bit more.
Yeah, and there's like these moments of epiphany that are very accessible to the reader. For example, in my case, when the brother puts the two frogs out on the dock and names one of them female, although she goes, well, I have no idea why is that one female? But anyway, when one eats the other, it reminds me of like, I was at the University of Florida when I was like, I don't know, I was younger than you then. But yeah, so I used to pick up chameleons. I liked looking at them because they looked back at you like they knew who you were.
Oh my like, God.
Looking right at you. And so this one chameleon is looking right at me like he knows who I am. And he opens his mouth and a spider walks out.
Oh my God.
And it was this moment of epiphany. Like I go, oh, okay. That's the way things are. Which reminds me of you, right?
Yeah. There's also this in Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, there's a moment when I think it's a frog suddenly just deflates because it gets eaten by something else. And that image has stuck with me since I read that book, you know, many years ago for the first time. Because when you attend to the things of the world, it's not all beautiful, right? When you pay attention over a long expanse of time, sometimes it's a frog having their insides sucked out before you too.
Well, another one was when I was talking about the trees cover a little bit more of the sky every year. So I have this fish pond and I put these little plants in called floaters. And I go, I need to get some more floaters. But the next day I came down and the floaters had expanded and covered the entire pond.
Oh my God.
And they have these little connections. They're not rhizomes, they're like tubules and they're all connected together. And I'm going like, wait, what is this? They're all like one organism. And then I felt horrible because I had to remove some and I couldn't do anything but let them die.
And yeah. I felt really
But and now they're doing it again.
Well, sometimes you gotta make the decision of who gets to live and who gets to die. It's like that in the book when the character is looking at the kite and the rabbit and she's trying to decide who she should feel allegiance for. How do we choose who, what kind of plant life that we feel allegiance to, what feels most alive to us?
Yeah, and she defaults to, you know, the chain, you know, the circle of life from Disney. You know, the idea that, yeah, the kite's doing exactly the right thing. It's got to do what it's got to do. And you know, sorry for the rabbit, but this is what the kite does. It's his existence, its very nature. But she's like, that's the thing. She second guesses that too. She second guesses everything.
Yeah, she does.
Because why?
I think that she is a character who is, for much of the narrative, as far as she'd like us to believe anyway, she's not somebody who has ever experienced herself as somebody who can make things happen in the world, who can affect change, who has an effect on people. She feels like somebody who's always affected by other people and influenced by other people. So at one point she talks about, you know, how she's always been susceptible to other people's big feelings, right? And I think there comes a certain point in the narrative when she maybe experiences herself for the first time as being able to exert a kind of power in the world through language. But it seems to be, again, this sort of a moment of epiphany because it's not something that she had felt capable of before.
Yeah, and the other thing is, when I look down, I'm taking notes. I'm listening to you, but I'm taking notes. Because I can't remember anything anymore. But now, I forgot what I was going to say because I was taking the notes. Oh, I know it. Because she very seldom talks about intimate moments. But when she does that one time, and this is something I remember, and maybe you even remember, it's like the idea of she's with someone and they're holding the back of her neck or there's stroking her arm, but she knows that they're thinking of somebody else. It's not her. She can't even give herself that credence. That's really sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I also think that in particular is not something that's maybe so unusual, that feeling, right? Because it's a kind of insecurity that is really writ large in her personality that becomes, you know, she doesn't have a kind of base platform from which she can operate, right? She has, you know, the void and the void. So there's nothing there that might make her think, actually, you know, maybe I am exaggerating, although there are points in the novel when she does think, is it possible that this wasn't really about me at all? And, you know, the townspeople aren't really feeling this sense of animosity. And then very quickly says, no, they definitely are. So there's something programmed into her that she feels this sense of abjection, really. And I think in a certain sense, she comes to like it. She pursues that sense of objection in a way too, which is part of, I think, what makes her, the way she is obedient, sort of pathological in a way that complicates the normal pathways of obedience, right? Where you're just obedient and then that's it, everybody's happy. But here, there's something about her very obedience that is really troubling to people as well.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that you never look at it as being masochistic, because it's obedience and she's not looking for pain. That's not what she's looking for. I don't know, what is she looking for? What is she looking for? Because she's happy. Like, there's like two times in the book that she was happy and I'm going, this is great. She's happy. Like once or twice.
I think, you know, she tries to find meaning in her life in various ways, right? And the ways that she tries to find meaning, like the way that a lot of people try to find meaning, is through narratives that other people have created. So, you know, she talks about the idea of the hero's journey that she can't identify with because she doesn't experience herself as a first person character or even, you know, a helper along the way. So she's looking to archetypes to try to help her understand how she fits into the world, and finds these archetypes not appropriate to her situation. So the other way is to kind of follow what the people closer to her tell her, which is, this is the way you have to behave. But that only works when they're in close proximity to her, right? Because she's spent some time away from them now, and she kind of has to retrain herself in some of the habits of doing for her brother.
Yeah, and doing for him everything, especially the dry brushing. But the other thing is, like, it borders on the perverse, but you don't think of it as being perverse, because he leaves the door open so he sees every aspect of her, and then he has to have her watch him dress in the doorway, in addition to the fact that she's giving him a bath. And yet, yeah, it kind of seems perverse, but then it fits in. It's just part and parcel of the way things work for her, right?
Yeah, and I think that maybe underscores as well the line between whether what she's doing is we're supposed to take at face value, or whether she in some ways understands the dynamic, which is that it's more than just somebody issuing orders and somebody being obedient, but she understands that there's something else going on in that dynamic, because she sort of says it with relish, right? Like, I did like to dress him, which, you know, in a different context outside of this novel would not be appropriate to say in polite company. Yeah, there's something really kind of bizarre about that.
But it's been her entire life, even from when she was an infant, and doing this practically impossible set of tasks for an enormous number of siblings unnamed. The only one we really get to learn is her big brother, who at first seems like he's put upon, but then all of a sudden he becomes this really cool, charismatic businessman who kind of controls the village and controls the world. He's, you know, what do you call him? He's like master of the universe, like in Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, until he gets sick.
Yeah, I think I was interested in establishing and subverting the dynamic from the get-go, right? So that we have what the narrator is saying, and then the position of her brother as she relates it. But equally, from the beginning of the novel, we have the brother relating in a kind of very vulnerable way these things that have happened to him. And she's not making light of it, but she sort of has to recalibrate what she has previously thought about their dynamic in order to understand what he's actually trying to say to her. And instead of understanding what he says to her, she just applies a totally different framework of understanding where she says, you know, I decided to listen not to the actual meaning of his words, but to the deeper meaning of, you know, what he obviously meant. So again, maybe she's right, and maybe she does know him better than the reader knows him. But equally, maybe she should have just listened to the literal meaning of his words.
Yeah, it's like the arc of her job, if you will, of transcription of this, of the pleadings or communications of this horrible company, this horrible law firm. But initially, she just loves what she's doing because it's not what they're saying, it's the way she's able to precisely and accurately put it together, especially with regard to semicolons. But then that changes too. There's an arc, it changes, and then she becomes not slovenly, but she approaches it from a completely different angle. And that was interesting too, because I wouldn't have thought she had a job, and a job so technical. She really relishes it at first.
Yeah, I think it's a job that provides a very clear structure to her and doesn't require her to in some ways think independently, right? Because her job is to transcribe literally what her colleagues are saying. And even within that, she has the system of grammar and the in-house style guiding her in how she types it. So she's very limited in the kind of independent decisions she might have to make, right? So she has kind of whittled that job down to the perfect job for her because it gives her exactly what she needs, a number of different structures, clear sets of rules, clear sets of parameters, and she doesn't want to necessarily understand the substance of the case itself. She deliberately, in fact, tries to avoid understanding what is going on with the case and instead occupies herself with this sort of literal transcription. And as you say, later on, there is a kind of shift in that she begins to become more interested in the idiosyncrasies of the way her colleagues communicate and attends to their voices and the shape and sound of what they're saying, which again, it's still not the meaning of their words, but she's kind of applying her own logic to her approach to the transcription later on in the novel.
Yeah, sound is very important to her. Especially at the end when she hears sound when there's no sound at all and it still is a sound. Or like, oh yeah, like watching TV and even being able to read lips. And then of course you do, when the actors are turned the other way, she still knows what they're saying. It's like watching NCIS, you know what's going on. Yeah. Anytime you turn TV, NCIS is there and you pretty much know what's going on.
Yeah, but that is literally the only television program that airs on UK TV at all times.
United States, you cannot turn on the TV without on one channel NCIS or CSI being
CSI.
On.
CSI, yeah.
And it's always CSI Hawaii or CSI Special Victims Unit or whatever.
I think they even have new NCISs too.
What happens in NCIS? I mean, there can't be that much going on. Well, so, you know, okay, talk about transcription. So, okay, this was in our book club, the fiction book club. You know, half the people are going to go, oh, transcription. Well, this is real and this is really happening and it's moving things along. But then she's in the diner and there's a guy with an unspeakable apron. And you go, oh, I don't know what that means. And then half the book club is like, well, why would she say that? What is that supposed to mean? But to me, it means a lot, but I can't tell you why it means a lot. And I have no idea how you came up with those two words together.
I guess I don't think I thought it was a surprising association, but I can see that it is.
Well, how many times do you think that someone has said or written those two words in the history of the universe?
I don't know. I guess it's a kind of contraction almost, right? Because it's the implication maybe is that it's an unspeakably filthy apron or something. But maybe this is almost a Freudian slip on the part of the author, because a lot of what I was interested in is like the limits of speakability, right? In the book, the limits of what language can communicate and the limits of what language can accommodate too. So maybe it was a bit of a slip, I think.
Well, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but you use the word Elysians twice in the novel. So you said contractions, and that's what those are. And
yeah.
So it's a novel of contractions in a way.
Yeah, I think it is, because she has this real interest in precision, or she claims to anyway, right? There's various points where she sort of steps outside of this telling of the story, and she says, you know, wait, let me start again. You know, actually, this is about this. We have to get this right. I want to be precise here. But then on the other hand, there's so much that she leaves out, so much of her everyday life, so much of, you know, the encounter she has and has had with other people. So that we only really get a shadowy sense of what her life is actually like, because it's all filtered through her consciousness. And I think in some ways, that is reflective of what I think about the way people think about themselves, right? So for example, you know, she doesn't have a name and people always ask about that. But I think my answer to that is often, if you think of yourself in the first person, you don't really think of yourself as having a name, right? You don't think your name. Somebody would have to speak it. But if you're the kind of person whose name is never spoken, it seems only natural that, you know, this character, for example, wouldn't have a name. But that's just one of the many things that we don't and can't learn about her, because she's limited by what she thinks that she's explaining in some ways, right? She thinks she's telling all, or she says she thinks she's telling all, but in fact, you know, she's not at all.
Yeah, it's like about her talking about organizing her consciousness. It's like, you know, I wake up in the morning and I got to do that too. And then at night, before I close my eyes, I do it again. Because the first thing I think when I wake up is, what the hell is this anyway? You know? It's like, what is this? And what am I in? But yeah, it's true that the reader is totally relying on her, because there's nothing else to rely on. And then I wasn't going to say unreliable, but you started out by saying unreliable. And so if she is unreliable, what is reliable? It's the same as the universe, I guess.
Yeah, I think I don't want to over determine it either, because I don't think that I'm even sure as the writer whether or not we're supposed to understand her as reliable. And I actually think that that's okay, because that is, you know, to a certain extent, all of us tell narratives about ourselves that are subjective and that are unreliable, right? But there's obviously a question of like how much effort you're putting into to it.
I know, it's like I'm going out to dinner. My wife and I are going out to dinner with a couple tonight, and I'll tell stories, but they're kind of lies, because my stories are semi-boring and I like to embellish them. But she always says, well, that's not what happened. I said, no, don't say that. I'm trying to make it interesting.
Yeah, but that is a truth, right? Like when you're embellishing a story to tell it in a way that is more interesting, whatever that means, that's an expression of a truth too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not harming it. It doesn't harm anyone. But and yeah, they do think you're cooler than you really are.
Yeah. It's definitely a question of scale, right? It depends, you know, the level at which you're embellishing.
Yeah, I'm not going to say, and then I killed him. But I mean,
Good.
but yeah, so what did I take notes on? Oh, yeah, I'm a bookseller. So the cover, because that's why, whether you like it or not, that's why your book's going to sell. And that's why necessarily you didn't pick your cover. The publisher did. Did you get to vet it?
Yeah, they sent it to me before and I said no notes. I absolutely loved it. I actually released a guffaw of laughter, as did other people I showed it to, because I just derived such a deep pleasure from the way that the designer understood the book. And other people have said it reminds them of Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch, which I think is also funny because it's like, yes, but the goldfinch is dead in this case. So yeah. I really like the cover.
Yeah, it's like, what did I do? I don't think I still have it. But my home screen for a long time is a dead bird. But it's just the head of a dead bird that I saw on the street in Chicago. And I took a picture of it. But it's just his head.
What kind of bird?
Like a finch. I wish I could find it. I don't want to mess around trying to look for it now. But yeah. So that really sounds so it's a great cover. And also it's in cursive, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Because he's writing the story.
I think so. I liked the scrawl that they used for it too, because there's something about it which suggests something kind of haphazard, but also really studied in the writing that I thought was cool. But yeah, it's not something you see very often, I guess, because they want the author's name to come across clearly. But
hey, do you have have a copy of the book there? You should hold it up.
I do, actually.
There. That's what we're trying to sell it. So that's good.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice cover.
Hold it up for a little bit more.
And the dead bird's on the back as well.
Look, you look like you're on The Price is Right, kind of like.
Oh, yeah. He just died. He was 99.
Yeah.
Bob Barker.
Yeah, 99 years old. But like my wife said, she goes, this sounds really bad, but I thought he was dead a long time ago.
Yeah, I saw another thing where somebody was like, he got as close as he could to 100 without going over.
Yeah, it's amazing because like Bob Hope and Groucho Marx and all these comedians end up to be 100 and then they die.
Yeah. It's too much. 100 is too much.
Yeah. But they, like George Burns, like I think he actually set up a show at the Palladium in London for when he had his 100th birthday. He did it like 30 years before that.
That is incredible. I have so little energy now, and I'm so far away from 100. I can't imagine planning a show at the Palladium.
Oh, yeah. Think what it's like when I'm... Oh, so I'm 71. So I bought this crematory urn that I put in the bookstore that says Samuel Hankin, 1952 to 2023. And so people come in the bookstore, and they go, Mr. Hankin's dead? Oh, I'm so then I'm like, shouldn't they be more sad than that? I mean, shouldn't they be like crying and bawling and like?
Is that the reaction that you'd want, do you think?
Yeah, I don't want them to say, oh, too bad. I mean, aren't I more important than that?
Yes, definitely. Okay. Is that why you got the urn, to test it?
No, I don't know. It's just what I do. And then if I don't die this year, then I got to buy another one that says 2024. But
that's true. You have to keep replacing.
Bought some little crematory urns too, just for fun. And people buy them. I had to get new ones.
Do they have your name on them too?
No, they're just little crematory urns. And I said, you know, like your cat could probably fit in there. And not to be morbid, but your puppy. But
yeah, she probably would.
But I digress, which is what happens. So now, okay, talk about the cover, and you've already mentioned one of the epigraphs. So talk a little bit about the epigraphs, because that's another thing people looked at right away.
Yeah, I think when I was coming to actually turning it into something that would have something like a story, that Paul Arago quote came to mind. So I had gone to a retrospective of the painter Paul Arago's work in Edinburgh a few years ago, and they had this, the gallery had this quote up on the wall from the artist where she says something like, "I can make, you know, my women obedient and murderous at the same time." Of course, I got very obsessed with that concept, which seemed somewhat like an oxymoron to me in some ways, but looking at her artwork, it's very clear to see how that dynamic is possible, because you see it in her paintings. So, you know, she has this painting called The Maids, where the maids are kind of lowering over the kind of mistresses they're supposed to be serving, and they look physically bigger, they look a little bit threatening, but not too threatening. So there's a sense of ambiguity in it as well. And I just thought, you know, this is incredible, because the structures of the world, right, like the structures of class and patriarchy and all of that are still in place in her paintings. But these characters that she is painting have somehow found a way to find agency within that. And that's what the focus of that work was for me. And I was wondering if it would be possible basically to translate that into language, and if so, what that would look like. So that really became the node where I thought, okay, well, what is the story? What is the basic dynamic here? Okay, it's a sister and a brother. You know, how can we sort of develop it from there?
Yeah, and then interiorly, you bring up Montaigne and Novalis as two other authors, both of whom, well, one she's instructed to read, and the other is the brother's favorite. Hey, Montaigne's father was a herring merchant.
Was he really?
Yes.
Yeah, so God, herring keeps cropping up in my life lately. That's really funny.
I know. See, I've been buying Vita herring for like 50 years, which is not the right kind, because it's in this sour cream sauce and it's like 10,000 calories a jar.
Oh, you're but supposed to get it in the pickly sauce?
Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked that as a kid too. They call it roll mops here. It's also a really Scottish thing. It's like one thing that the Jews and the Scots share in common, pickled herring.
It's different. It's like anchovies, you know. I get them on my Caesar salad, but they're completely different when you get them in Italy or Spain.
Yeah, that's true.
I like the bad ones. There's an interesting line.
I like the bad ones.
So why did you choose Montaigne and Novalis? I mean, there's lots of other people you could have chosen.
I had been reading Montaigne's essays the summer that I was writing, and I think he was in my head because I was trying to figure out, you know, which is something the narrator talks about too, right? Like how, you know, just thinking about that these thoughts, and this is the case for obviously so much of literary history in every language, right? But how does it happen that certain things make it through the centuries and other things don't? So I think, yeah, the Montaigne stuff, I was thinking about it in terms of rules for living, right? But also just the concept of the essay as like a little effort in thought, right? A little trying out this little idea. But if the brother is somebody who sort of looks at these things as instructions for living, there's a kind of interesting tension there. And the Novalis is in some ways a reference to Thomas Bernhard, whose character has always seemed to be trailing about a copy of Novalis too. And there, it always takes on a kind of sinister cast, I think, for some reason. So that is a little bit of a nod to Bernhard as well.
The thing is that Montaigne didn't really like love, and Novalis did. It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that was the brother's love, Novalis, but he instructs her to read Montaigne. That's actually very interesting if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the the way, I guess, that he tries to get her to divest emotion from action, right? Or her own emotions anyway, not his emotions, but her emotions.
It's funny because sometimes you feel like you're living in the past in the book, and then all of a sudden the brother has all the same things I have, like temper.
Linens, a convection oven.
Yeah, convection oven, linens. Oh, what else? There's a whole list of really good ones. Shit, what are they? What are the rest of them? Do you remember?
A thick slice toaster.
Oh, five slice. Yeah, right. Oh, no, six slice. So there's a whole bunch of them, but they're all really good. And then, I go, oh, okay, so this is the real world, and it's now, and he did a really good job of fixing the place up. And then the other one is, it's exactly 75% into the book, but it's the first time you call men sad scumbags.
It's the only time, too, in my defense.
It is. And it's the only time you bring in cancel culture. And you seem to be talking about the negative aspects of cancel culture and the fact that it's ruined so many people's lives, which is interesting.
Well, this is, of course, ventriloquized through the brother, right? So, or as far as the narrator is concerned, it's ventriloquized through the brother. So I think it needs to be read in that context, which is to say the brother, who has a specific relationship to power, is making these claims that are also related to how he perceives of the kind of history of the place as well. And he has a particular stake in it. So even if this is not what the brother says, it's what the sister, you know, would put into his mouth as something that we're supposed to understand it is attributed to him rather than to her. And the things that she does agree with him on are more to do with the affordances of language, what language can do in the world, what actions it can do, what it makes possible. So I think there is a bit of confusion within that section in particular as to how much allegiance she has to these ideas and how much she's separating herself from them as well.
She likes to explain things appropriately. Like, and this is another two words that no one has ever uttered, metaphorical skirts. It's like, you know, she wants to make sure that everyone knows she doesn't wear skirts, she wears pants. But nonetheless, the metaphor would fit. But that's something that, you know, it's like, you know, descending the stairs in the skin of her sister and then becoming her sister. And then you're, okay, that should take care of things, but it doesn't. You know, that should take care of, okay, she's her sister, but she's not. And that's where the unreliability, I think, comes in.
Yeah, she sometimes pays attention to the wrong things, right? Or exerts her power or interest in precision in weird ways, like as you're pointing out, it doesn't really, it's just a metaphor, right? It doesn't need to be explained, that you express your gender in a particular way. Like, it's not actually related to that. That's not what the idea is about. So she gets stuck on the words themselves rather than what they mean in that case, I think.
Well, it's like, but then sometimes she kind of makes her bed by, like, why does she decide to make these little, you know, gnomons of these? She decides, you know, she's going to weave baskets, and all of a sudden she goes, oh no, I know what I'll do. I'll make these little creatures and put them on the doorstep of everybody's house. They'll love that. And then, you know, they put them all in the pit, but then they're out of the pit. It reminded me a little bit of The Magus by John Fowles. Like, you're not quite sure whether they're fooling her, you know, whether they're fooling her.
Yeah.
Like Eyes Wide Shut or something, you know?
Yeah. I think that is another thing that I was interested in thinking about, right? Who actually has the power here, and what are we supposed to understand it, you know, is the basis of this relationship? Because, as you know, we've been talking about, we only really have her words that this is what the townspeople are thinking. Because it's a weird thing to do, right? So in some ways, it makes sense that they're purging the town of the dolls, but in other ways, are they doing it as a performance? Is this, you know, expressly for her? Yeah. So I think I was always sort of playing with that line, I think.
It does so happen that she comes to the place when everything's going wrong, you know, phantom pregnancies and sows. And so, yeah, I can kind of understand that, but only in a kind of medieval sense, which is where the automatic doors at the airport come in and like, go, okay, this is not what I think it is. And yeah, so everything goes wrong. And then the other thing is, you know, she has a facility in language, and then going back to words, she tries, but she can't learn one word in the language of the village. Not one word.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is maybe related to the problem of who has the power in the relationship between herself and the townspeople as well, because she says that it's not a choice. She says that, you know, I really tried hard. Are we supposed to take that at face value again? You know, but on the other hand, is there something in the language itself that is resistant to somebody like her learning it? Like the land, right, which she can't read, even though, you know, it should be possible to use, for example, a plant identifier app, right, that would give her the answers that she wants. It wouldn't work. There's something about, you know, these two things, I think, meet halfway, right? The land and the language remain impenetrable, but likewise, her understanding is limited too, whether that's by sort of choice or something else is left an open question, I think.
Yeah, and it's funny too, when the woman comes and just stands there with her dog, implicating a dog that's cannot impregnate another dog. And he was really funny too. He had his own personality and three legs.
Bert. Yeah. Bert. The named character.
I know. Well, as we wind down here, because it's been over an hour now. So you talked earlier about, I said, hey, you know, prose poetry, this sounds like poetry too. And then you go, well, maybe I'll do something else later. So are you starting something now? You know, Terry Gross kind of question. Are you starting something now that's like not prose, not poetry, or a combination of both?
A new interest, which is not to say that it will turn into anything, but my latest interest is I got really obsessed with Scottish land court decisions, some of which are available online. And I got really interested in them because, well, partially because there was a local case that I wanted, just in a kind of nosy way, to know more about. And when I read it, I realized that whoever's writing these things, it just has an amazing appreciation for language and humor, and is very, very salty, and is in no way sort of objective in their assessments of the case. And I mean, I don't know what I expected, but I think just some boring legalese, but actually the drama and the feeling of all of these like more recent cases is really evoked. And I just had a great time reading them. I thought they were all hilarious. And so I'm thinking about, because one of the things I'm really interested in too is like the politics of land ownership, particularly up here where I live in the Highlands. So thinking about, you know, something related to that. And then maybe also because I have this sort of abiding Shirley Jackson in the back of my head at all times, that, you know, give it a haunted house. So yeah. Those are kind of the things that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, there's the dread. Yeah, when I went to law school and I had to take criminal law, which is not what I did, but it was really fun reading all the criminal law cases, especially when the judge took this sardonic tack in writing the opinion. And he was enjoying writing it, and he spent a lot of time trying to be funny, even though on my
head,
yeah. And I loved reading those. It was the one thing, the rest of it was all dry, but reading those was so much fun. And yeah.
Yeah, see, this is an amazing revelation to me that this is a thing. And I am really delighted that somebody is having fun with it all. Yeah, so we'll, yeah, it'll be something about that.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's just another aspect of something that's very clear in your life as a person and as a writer is that you're fascinated by language. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I realized when I started having to talk about how I write that actually, maybe in a really inefficient way, I tend to actually pay more attention to the sound of things, maybe some a little bit like the narrator at some points, rather than their sense, which is why I have to make a concerted effort to come up with story. And it's also why I'm not that interested in plot, because I'm more interested in the way language can flow, but in the way it can also stick, and in the way it can slow you down when you're reading or speed up. So pacing, but yeah, just finding ways to disrupt or enable the flow of a sentence tends to be what I focus on.
Yeah, disrupt. Short, sharp shocks. And yeah, so keep writing about unspeakable aprons, whether they're just dirty or I'm supposed to think there's something else. And that's the other good thing about the book is after you're done, even though it's one reading, you spend a lot of time thinking, what the hell is that?
Somebody actually sent me one of my favorite ever Goodreads reviews. Somebody had given it 3 stars, which I think is pretty good, you know, and was like, I'm really disturbed, but why? It's like,
it's funny when the bookstore gets Yelp reviews. I mean, we have tons of 5-star ones, but I love getting the 1-star ones because they're so funny.
They are funny.
If you read TripAdvisor, you know, 1-star because the shower head was calcified.
Yeah, or like this mountain had no bathroom at the top. Which is one I saw recently for a local, like a mountain local test.
Well, okay, we're done. Thank you so much. That's how I end these things. Okay. Unless you don't want it to be done, but you know, we've covered a lot.
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. This was fun.
Thank you, Sadis. It was fun. Hopefully I'll talk to you about Scottish land cases within the next couple of years.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
Okay. Talk to you soon then. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Thank you.
Yep.